Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Okay, before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to subscribe, like, hit the notification bell, and if you're really loving us, give us a five-star review. So today we are going to be talking about the challenges keeping cannabis compliant. So I am thrilled to get the perspective of the CEO and founder of Alay Consulting. Please welcome Kim Stuck. Thank you so much for, you know, taking the time to sit with us.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. Happy to be here.
Awesome. And as always, I am pleased to welcome the Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data, Mr. John Cagia. Welcome.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. All right. So, Kim, you were the nation's first cannabis and hemp specialist for a major metropolitan public health authority. So walk me through that. Like, where were you in your career and how did you become the first?
Well, it was kind of one of those things. I think a lot of people in this industry, opportunity kind of lands in your lap sometimes, which I was very thankful for. I originally was a wholesale food and restaurant health inspector for the city and county of Denver. And in 2014, adult use became recreationally legal. They actually started, you know, issuing licenses and started opening dispensaries and that kind of thing during that time. And Denver has a very strict policy when it comes to public health and safety. Their health department is very involved because, you know, there's such a huge population there that if one restaurant or wholesale food manufacturing makes a bunch of people sick, it's an issue. So they were very concerned about cannabis, how it was being stored, you know, how it was being processed, all the food safety implementations and like all the things that in normal wholesale food manufacturing exist. But in cannabis, if nobody's regulating it to that standard, then who knows what's happening, right? So we had to kind of go in and the bosses at that time were like, okay, everybody just start going into dispensaries and into manufacturing facilities. And none of us knew anything about cannabis, really. It was a little shocking. We really quickly realized that it's very, very different than wholesale food manufacturing, very different from restaurants, obviously. And really they just needed someone to be dedicated to cannabis. And I just happened to be the person that kind of fell into that role. And I was very grateful for that. I ended up falling in love with the industry. Obviously I was very intrigued and, it's very, I don't know. It doesn't happen very often when you're a regulator to have a completely new industry, you know, something completely new to learn. And I was very excited for that opportunity. Did that for a little over 3 years and finally decided that I could do more good for the industry as a whole if I actually was a consultant working for them, because there was a lot of just confusion over regulations. You know, regulations are written in a very specific way that's almost like a regulatory jargon. It's hard for normal people to understand exactly what they're asking for and things like that. What are they actually looking for? What does adequate hot water mean? Things like that, vague, you know, regulations. And so I'm kind of one of those people that's there to kind of handhold our clients, if you will, and walk them through it and help them, you know, become above and beyond when it comes to regulations and being compliant with things. So it's been really great. We're very happy to be here and to be doing this for a living. It's crazy.
That's so interesting. I worked in a restaurant in Georgetown years after college. And so I feel like I'm making the comparison. Like, would you say, other than it being new to you, I mean, do you think that cannabis is so much more complicated than like a restaurant, or do you think it's more, is it just different?
So it's different, and it is far more complicated. I actually, more than comparing it to a restaurant, I compare them to wholesale food manufacturers.
Right.
And because of the nature of cannabis, like the plant itself, and like the oils and the processes, the extraction processes, you know, hydrocarbon extractions and CO2 extractions and ethanol extractions and using pentane and hexane. I mean, that's like very high-end high level chemicals, and you have to store them correctly. You have to, you know, make sure you have proper ventilation and class one, division one blast rooms and all these like crazy things that do not really exist in a wholesale manufacturing facility. Like if you're making regular brownies per se, rather than infused brownies, it's very different. Also with a plant, like a cannabis plant, this is an example I give a whole lot. You know, if you're picking berries, a lot of the same pesticides and things like that are used on like berry crops and grapes, things like that. But when we take a cannabis plant down and chop it up and bring it into a facility to process it, you can't wash that cannabis plant, right? Whereas with grapes and berries and things, you actually put them through a wash, make sure pesticides are off of them at a very low level, bring them in. With cannabis, you can't do that because you lose all the trichomes and stuff. So there's different processes that have to take place in order to prevent, you know, contamination of like carcinogenic pesticides and things like that. I mean, that's just like a couple of examples, but it is very different from just like your regular produce or, you know, your regular like brownie facility if you're just like baking brownies or, you know, not extracting. And I think that that was a bit of a shock when we first started going in. I think we were expecting just to see normality, and it was absolutely not. The first extraction lab I went into, it was like Breaking Bad. You know, I didn't even know what I was looking at. It's like, what are they making? There's like hoods and, you know, all this stuff bubbling and, you know, right. It was just like crazy. Like I had to have them really like talk it through. And thankfully the people in the industry were so happy that they were, you know, licensed and able to do this for a living, that many of them, most of them, you know, welcomed me in and was just like, please come in, learn, you know, and they kind of taught me from a ground level all the processes. And back then, and still to this day, there's about 2000 plus licenses in Denver that I've been in and have learned a lot from. So thank God for the industry and welcoming me with open arms into their facilities when I was a regulator, because that's where I got my education from.
That's amazing. That's definitely the right time, right place.
John,
do you have any questions for Kim?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, you've literally gotten to watch the arc of evolution of this market. What are some of the kind of differences you see now in terms of the compliance challenges that the operators are facing now versus back when you started this in the Breaking Bad days of extraction?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on the state. So we work in all 50 states. We also work out of country in a few instances. So each state is kind of at a different level of understanding and maturity, right? So Colorado in 2014, we didn't have potency regulations. So you would go in and buy a brownie and you had no idea how many milligrams of THC was in it. You didn't know how high you were going to get from that brownie. You know, that was the original like medical rules that were in place. And obviously when it became adult use, they started to change some of those laws and they started to do, you know, testing for pesticides and heavy metals and these things because it was starting to be sold to the general public. So, you know, back in the day, it was like the Wild West, right? People were just making brownies and things at home and like wrapping them in cellophane and selling them. There was no labeling. There was no, you know, it was just kind of crazy to, from a food safety and public health standpoint, I was like, what is going on? Like, and then we were running into like, you know, it's a very innovative industry. Like the people in this industry are so passionate about what they do. They absolutely love it. And they are entrepreneurs like crazy. So there are infused tampons and suppositories and inhalers and nasal sprays and eye drops, all these things that like you don't just find on the shelves of like normal, you know, like a 7-Eleven or something. And so because it's medical, even when it's recreational in a way, you know, everybody, you know, uses it for something, sleeping or just relaxing at the end of the day. So it is kind of, I don't know, there's a lot of medical applications without it actually being regulated as a medicinal thing. So it was a huge challenge in the beginning because there weren't really regulations written specifically. We kind of had to start from scratch. We couldn't steal regulations from any other state because we were the first state, which nowadays I feel like New York and New Jersey and Michigan and all, they kind of have an advantage because they can look at other people's regulations and kind of pick and choose what they want to use. We didn't have that luxury, unfortunately. So it was a lot of trial and error, a lot of wait a minute, this is a thing. There's mycotoxins, the, you know, mold that's growing on this, or the pesticide thing. We didn't even think about pesticides in the beginning. We didn't think that it would transfer over to the products. And it definitely does. In fact, it like increases the amount quite a bit because it extracts it. You know, we didn't think about heavy metals. Cannabis is very different than other plants. It sucks up heavy metals. It's a great bioremediator. So if you have lead or mercury or anything like that in your soil, it'll suck it right up and it goes directly into the concentrates or into your lungs if you're smoking it. So there's a lot of things that are very different in the industry than other industries. But now that we've been doing it for long enough, we've really dialed in like where those regulations should be in mature states like Oregon and Colorado and California, where they're getting it there and everything. But then you go to a state that's like Oklahoma or New York, you know, everything is still kind of up in the air. They're still trying to figure it out. And then it's almost like going back in time when I go and do audits in those newer states, because people are still not used to being regulated. They don't understand that regulatory jargon very well. And so it still, it feels like I have to like go back in time a little bit and prepare my mind to be in some of those earlier, you know, earlier states that are coming online.
Well, that is so interesting. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for the background. All right, well, we'll move on. News3LV reported licenses suspended for North Las Vegas cannabis cultivator over multiple issues. So the Nevada Cannabis Compliance Board recently voted to suspend Desert Bloom's cultivation and manufacturing licenses after finding that cannabis plants and packages were untagged or improperly tagged and not tracked in the state's seed to sale tracking system. So just given that example, Kim, which sector of the industry do you think has like the most harsh compliance requirements?
I would say manufacturing cultivation. Obviously that's like where most of it, I mean, dispensary storefronts are pretty minimal, right? It's not so hard to run one of those. And the reasoning is because of things like this. People aren't trained. So I read the article, and the reason why it's a public health and safety is because they weren't able to link test results with the product that was being sold. And that's the issue. This is not necessarily that facility didn't test. It's not necessarily that they did anything that could directly affect. I mean, obviously there were some tests that came back that were not okay, but not with everything in it from the years, I think like September 2021 to now, which is a big chunk of time. It's really that their record keeping and documentation, it sounds like that was where the fault was at. Not being able to link, you know, test results to the products. Maybe, you know, there could be some shady stuff going on, but I like to always give the benefit of the doubt. This happens all the time. When I was a regulator, in fact, I used to go in to facilities, and do, you know, if we got a complaint or something came back testing hot for, we'll just say a pesticide, we would have to go in. And if they couldn't prove to us through documentation where that particular concentrate came from, what grow it came from, where it came from, where the test results for that batch number was, if they weren't keeping batch number systems in place, and Metric does a very terrible job of this, by the way, it's actually like one of the worst track and trace systems I've ever seen. So it's very difficult for operators to be able to do this. They kind of have to do it on their own. And if they're not doing that, we used to have to do an any and all recall. So if one product was contaminated and they couldn't prove to us through documentation and testing and keeping track of linking everything together, we would assume that every product that they have ever made in the entire lifetime of their company was contaminated. And so then we would have to, literally do a recall on everything they've ever made. And that happened several times when I was working there. So I kind of feel like this is the same kind of deal. I think that they didn't keep track of the testing, what batches it was linked to. I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of issues that were going on, not just this, but I feel like this was the main issue. And if they would have had documentation and some kind of good manufacturing practices in place to be able to track and trace and tell regulators, no, this is a test result for all of this. This is where this came from. This is where this went. then they would probably have a better chance at least of having a smaller recall. But this kind of thing happens in wholesale food manufacturing a lot as well. If they mislabel something like an allergen, let's say peanuts got mixed in with something, obviously you'd have to do a recall. Or if maybe they just labeled it wrong and didn't say that there was peanuts or something in it, then that is also a problem and they would have to do a recall for that. So this is kind of part of doing business, is being able to go through recalls and do it in an effective, way that's quick and makes regulators happy. It's always a good thing to do, but I had a feeling when I was reading that it was mostly that they could not prove or like have enough documentation for what was happening in their facility.
Yeah, it seems like as this industry matures, they're going to have to be held to a higher standard like other kind of industries. John, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to what Kim has said that's both really compelling and is likely going to be a pretty significant issue as we go through this next chapter of industry expansion and growth. So first is this idea of maintaining protocols and processes when you're going through an explosive period of growth. You look at a market like Nevada, where the product is just flying off the shelves, and you can kind of understand from the part of the growers and the manufacturers, like, I just want to get this product out the door. And so having kind of operational structures and processes where, regardless of how busy you are, there's an institutional-wide or organization-wide expectation that, these processes are going to be followed to the T. There's absolutely a tension there. We hear this kind of protest from operators, particularly kind of the middle and lower level staff, where like they hate how much time it takes because their passion is the plant, the passion is the extraction. And shoot me first if I have to sit here and fill out all of these forms and keep track of all of this. But this is the kind of thing that can break a business. But second, I think it also speaks to the opportunity for technologies that will help make this process easier for the businesses. We've been hearing complaints about metrics since the beginning of the market. and candidly, there continues to be a lot of the platforms that have tried to fill that gap continue to have room for improvement. We don't necessarily think that any one C2Sale platform or a complement to the C2Sale platforms have fully kind of made this as seamless as it can be. I think there's continued room for growth, and God bless the technologists. They're working as hard as they can to fix this gap, because everybody recognizes how much of a resource burden that these compliance requirements are for the business. But I think it also speaks to an opportunity for an industry that is only going to continue to grow, become more competitive. These businesses are only going to have more product that they need to track, more capacity that they need to account for. And so this isn't a problem that's going to be going away anytime soon. And I think therein lies the opportunity to really build solutions that help minimize how much time employees are spending being compliant, and to make it much easier for organizations to implement these processes kind of organization-wide, so that when you have new employees coming through, we do see quite a bit of turnover in these companies. When you have new employees come through, it becomes really easy to plug them into a well-refined and easy to comply with set of protocols.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's why a lot of companies nowadays are looking towards things like GMP certification from a third-party accredited, certifying body, because it's the next best thing to being regulated by the FDA, right? They're choosing to implement things and follow through the same way a wholesale food manufacturer does. Everyone's like, oh, we're so regulated, but they haven't even dealt with FDA or, OSHA yet. And that's kind of why I'm always working with my clients to think of that next level. What's going to happen to you when the FDA starts coming in? What's going to happen when OSHA shows up? Because they will show up if they get a complaint. It has happened a lot lately. And it's interesting because, just like you said, once technologies start coming through, that's part of what GMP process is figuring out what technologies are going to work and which ones are going to help you implement and keep up with doing it and help your employees understand what is required of them, right? And I also have learned that with GMP certification, because it's so spelled out and there's good trainings and things like that, it actually like slows down the turnover a bit. People who like to work in companies where they know what their job is and they know what is expected of them, and they feel, you know, fulfilled by that. Also having like that sense of pride of, hey, we're making a really, really clean, good product that's safe for consumers. And I know it because we follow all these protocols and other people don't. That's like a really good feeling for a lot of people. So we found that a lot of our clients that get GMP, their turnover goes down. So it's kind of exciting. It was like a, I don't know, happy accident, I guess.
Well, and I think you make a really important point about GMP as being, you know, almost kind of being beyond compliant. So you have your state regs, but GMP helps take you a level above that. And I think you're dead on about, you know, this gets you well prepared for the inevitable federal tranche of regulations that are going to be coming and going to be imposed on this industry. But I think there's also a couple of additional dimensions there. One, with federal normalization, we're going to see interstate commerce. And while there's a lot of variability in the rules across states, much easier if your rules are going to be compliant across every market, because it makes that process of expansion much easier. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with the potential for international trade, international expansion, your product isn't leaving this country or going to be imported anywhere unless it meets at a minimum a GMP standard. So getting the organization kind of oriented to these best practices now puts you in really good stead for the evolving market as we're seeing it. And then finally, as we look at the competitive landscape, we are going to continue to see a great deal of M&A activity in this space. And like it or not, you know, there's a great debate about whether all of these deals are good for the industry, because one of the results is going to be greater consolidation. But, you know, there is some utility in that capital being harnessed in unified organizations. And so for companies that might be looking for that exit, that might be looking for that kind of partnership with larger brands or with strategic partners in other markets, having very strong compliant processes is going to be key to that conversation taking place. You know, most investors, most large players in this space aren't really going to have a great deal of interest in trying to acquire a shop that they're going to have to come in and then teach you how to run your business right. And so the better kind of the more efficient that you are as you go into those conversations, I think the more likely those conversations are going to be fruitful.
Yeah, I can't agree more. And then you look at the way that other countries are starting to do it. I mean, this is going to be a global economy eventually, right? I already have clients in the Bahamas and Virgin Islands and South Africa and Israel. And it's kind of crazy where the Canadian government, which I love what they did, they just legalized it, you know, outright. And then they're requiring things like ISO 22000, which is what is usually used or required in most European countries to sell your ingredients and whatnot internationally, right? So it's a higher level of GMP, but it's essentially, you know, it covers the same bases. They're looking at requiring that. All of their standards are very high for their health and safety. They're essentially setting up all of their businesses, as much as the businesses don't like it right now, they're setting all of their business up to automatically be part of that international sales force, right? They will be able to go, oh, you know, Germany just legalized. We can already sell to Germany. We have already have all the all the standards and the safe product and all the certifications to automatically be a part of that global market. Whereas the way that the United States has kind of done this, I have a feeling that if we don't, you know, federally legalize and then require some kinds of standards at this, you know, that are kind of high end when it comes to health and safety, we could potentially fall behind. And I have a feeling that a lot of countries like Canada are just going to, you know, take over the market because they'll be able to. They'll be in a position that they can do that.
I mean, with all these East Coast markets coming online, what do you think the lessons they can learn from these established markets? Or what do you think are the top things that they should be taking away from that?
Well, I think a lot of them already are. I mean, when you're in Florida, if you own a THC company, you have to have GMP certification to even get a license. And that is happening more and more. I'm seeing that in regulations across the board. If you're in New York and you have a CBD edible company or beverage company, you have to have GMP certification. You have to get it within 6 months of getting your license, if not before you get your license. So this is a trend that we're seeing. It also kind of takes a lot of work off of our regulators' laps, right? I mean, it's kind of crazy when you think about it. You think of like Oklahoma, 14,000 businesses were born in 1 month. How do regulators do 14,000 inspections like within 2 months? You can't do it. It's just like, so if they require like, hey, you have to get a third party certification to the standard, then their health department doesn't have to do as many on-site visits, if any. You know, a lot of times by just requiring that you get a certification, it takes it kind of off of the regulator's plate, or at least for a little while for them to build up their, you know, hire enough people to be able to enforce, and then maybe they'll change those laws. But I'm seeing that more and more and more. It's kind of putting the onus of health and safety, consumer safety, onto the companies, even though it's a bit more costly, you know, some, but to the regulators, that's a better idea, because how do you scale fast enough to be able to regulate these facilities if it's, you know, if it's just their health and safety standards. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. There's ups and downs to both, you know, pros and cons to both sides of the argument, but it is a trend that I'm seeing, and I'm also seeing it in other countries as well. So like I said, Canada, they are requiring GMP and things like that, ISO 22000 eventually. So it's just a matter of time before this is a trend. And when you look at wholesale food manufacturing, GMP and things are not required, but you are not going to be able to sell your product unless you have it. That's just the way that it, I mean, you're not going to sell to Whole Foods, you're not going to sell to King Soopers, you're not going to sell it on Amazon unless you have GMP certification. And that's the way it's been for, you know, years and years and years. So I'm not surprised that cannabis will be going in the same trend.
Well, you mentioned, you know, you wish the US would just have legalized like Canada did. So we currently have two new federal legalization proposals presented in Congress, the COA and the SRA. What are your thoughts on these? Because I know we, John and I, we've talked about this to death. Like, when is this going to happen? You know, the hurry up and wait. We're not ready, but we want it to happen. We don't have anything in place. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I'm very pro federal legalization, right? I believe that that should be the way forward. I really want businesses to thrive. It is very hard to operate right now when you're in three different states. And I don't think it needs to be. I think that we can be able to across the board consolidate regulations. It'll take time. It'll take money. I don't think that that's how it's going to go in the beginning, but getting the FDA and OSHA involved is going to be very important to the industry. And it'll actually, in my opinion, being regulated as one is going to help the companies understand what is required, less gray area. And also it'll help with all the weird things that we have to deal with, 280E and banking and all of these things. I mean, we can't even function as real companies. I'm an ancillary business and I've been kicked out of three banks and can't get payment processing. It's absolutely ridiculous. I talk to people from outside the industry and they're like, wait, how do you even run a business? And I'm like, that's a good question. How do they run a business without a bank? It's kind of crazy to me that it's gone this far without getting there. So either one of these passing will take care of a lot of those issues as well. The States Reform Act is a little less, it's more bipartisan. You know, I like the tax rate a little better. It's a little, but it's kind of like very light, right? It's not, it doesn't really talk about social equity. It does talk about veterans and things like that. So it is doing some good. But the, you know, the COA is the one that's like, okay, we're going to take care of this from a social equity standpoint, which I love. And you know, we're going to do all these things, and there's going to be a lot of moving parts, and we're going to get, you know, the FDA involved. Whereas the States Reform Act is a little more, hey, we'll just let states kind of do what they want to do and see how it goes. And I think that both are valid, right? I think that if either one of them passes, it's going to be good for the industry. But when we leave things to the states, we're still going, you know, which is fine. And I think that it'll always be like that a little bit, no matter what. There's going to be regulations that your local jurisdiction, your state jurisdiction will have. But I think that having, you know, the FDA and OSHA involved is going to be key to just to the industry being growing. It's going to be, and having those regulations in place. Right now, most state regulators from health and safety standpoint don't have the bandwidth to get into these places. There are entire states that don't even get involved. In fact, even Colorado's state health department didn't get involved until just a few years ago in cannabis, which is, to me, from a public health standpoint, completely terrifying. And we are waiting right now for CBD regulations from the FDA, and we've been waiting over 3 years for those. And, you know, to me, that's a huge ethical dilemma. Their one job is to protect consumers. And there's an entire industry out there that is making things that they are not regulating. I think that's a huge problem. And I'm surprised that there isn't some kind of public outroar about it. I talk about it all the time because I think it's insane. But, you know, hopefully we get those regulations. Then we'll have an idea of how the FDA is going to regulate. Because from a health and safety standpoint, THC oil and CBD oil from a food safety standpoint are exactly the same. The only difference is obviously children, right? If they ingest THC, you know, there's got to be labeling and childproof packaging and that kind of thing. But from like a handling standpoint, it's all about the same. So it'll give us a really good idea of what those regulations are going to look like in the future. So I'm hoping that those come out soon. We haven't really gotten word in quite some time. COVID, I think, slowed them down and that kind of thing. But I think that if either of these pass, it will be a good thing. It'll be a step in the right direction. But I think that it might be a mistake to leave out worker safety and food safety from a federal standpoint, mainly because of the bandwidth issues. It's not necessarily the health departments in states or local health departments' fault that they can't get in to regulate cannabis. It's just they don't have enough people. They don't have the bandwidth to be able to do it, and they're going to need some help from the federal government to get into all these places and make sure that they're following the rules. And it'll make it way less black or way less gray. It'll be a lot more black and white if they say, hey, we're going to regulate this as a supplement or as a pharmaceutical or as a food ingredient. You know, they're going to figure it out. Like I said, there's a lot of nuances. So they're going to have to write a little chapter that is specific to cannabis, like the testing and the handling of the plant and all that fun stuff, but they don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, we've been doing food safety for forever and ever. And so we already have regulations that make sense when applied to the cannabis industry. They need to be added to, if that makes sense.
No, that makes total sense. I think that this is one thing that it does make sense to just handle it like food and safety, just because I think we've talked about how people wanted to handle it just like alcohol. And you're like, well, it's not really like alcohol. And they were trying to find a way to just shoehorn it. John, what are your thoughts on this? I'm like loving this take. I don't think we've had a food safety perspective on this.
Yeah, I think King is bang on, but all of the questions that she's just raised are part of the reason why it's going to be so difficult to get federal reform done. It's finding enough votes to support a framed regulation, at least a framework for a regulation that can bring in together this very complicated group of stakeholders to reach consensus. You know, there's a couple of tensions I think we're dealing with. One is both CAOA and SRA, there's actually a lot of alignment there in the broad points. The devil is always in the details. And, you know, trying to find enough support for some of these key points, whether it's social equity, whether it's the taxation rate, veterans research, records expungements and prisoner releases, the specific roles of the DEA and FDA in the administration of the industry and interplay in regulatory governance between the federal government and the state government. Everybody agrees that these are issues that need to be addressed, but I think there still remains some pretty steep partisan divisions on precisely how to do that. So I think we'll get there. You know, the market, I don't think will kind of lumber along indefinitely without there ultimately getting to be some framework for federal regulation. But I think the presentation of the COA and the debate that stimulated really underscored how intractable some of these issues are. That said, I actually think, you know, the recognition that it might take a little longer to get that broad-based, comprehensive policy reform done has people now looking back at the Safe Banking Act and saying, okay, maybe can we at least get banking done? Because having a $40 billion industry that isn't banked is just not sustainable. The operating costs, or one, just the operational risks of having that much cash flowing through the business and some of the creative ways in which operators have tried to find ways to manage the money. It's risk, both in terms of security and in terms of legal liability. Second, you know, the it is now more than abundantly clear how much of a constraint or constrictor of growth these astronomical expenses that businesses are paying for their capital are. You know, if you're paying a 25% interest rate, you're going to be much less likely to invest in to make capital expenditure investment, much less likely to invest in R&D. You know, the bulk of your profits, your bulk of your revenue is going to be servicing debt, which, you know, serves as a drug on industry growth. So particularly as we look at the expansion of the East Coast markets, and New York and Virginia, I think, are going to be particularly strong kind of players in this. New York is the financial capital of the world, Virginia for its proximity to DC. Some of these issues that I think are going to become a little more apparent than they might have been to the federal lawmaker class than they were when they were largely a Western state factor. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next, say, 12 months around this debate on getting safe banking done independent of a broader regulatory framework. But given everything else that's going on in the world right now, and given how acrimonious the political climate is in Washington, looks like, you know, no one seems particularly inclined to give the other side a win. So we'll see what happens with cannabis. But I'm a little more hopeful now about perhaps safe banking getting done, or some type of banking reform getting done. But even that's going to be a tough political negotiation, given everything else that's happening in the world.
Yeah, and you think about public safety. I remember when I for the years I was a regulator, and even now, you know, I'll do an audit and I sit down in the back room of these dispensaries and I'll be typing up my report, and I look around and I realize it's shoeboxes just lined to the ceiling that are completely filled with cash. There's, you know, millions of dollars right there. And I'm thinking to myself, why am I in this room? Somebody could just come in with a gun at any point. We're putting a lot of people at risk by not allowing this. And it's also opening up our opportunities for us not to be able to track where that money is going or where it's coming from. I know that everything is in these track and trace systems, sure, but that doesn't mean that, you know, having it go through a bank and through a financial system is an even better way to make to show, right, as a business owner, that we're doing the right thing. Look, this is exactly how much we have. This is exactly where it came from. This, you know, and it's hard to do that when you don't have access to banking or payment processing. The COA, I feel like a lot of people are, at least the people that I speak to on a daily basis, are really concerned about the tax rate that, you know, I mean, it starts at 10%, I think, and then every year it goes up and it gets to 25%. Whereas with SRA, I think it's 3%, which is a lot more palatable, but it also, once again, you're leaving that to the states and the federal government isn't getting involved as much. So, you know, that's another thing. I mean, I don't know how I feel. I don't like a really high tax rate. Don't get me wrong. But if we could write things off in our business and get rid of 280E and have banking where we're not paying $2,000 a month for a checking account, maybe the tax won't kill us quite as bad. right? Right now, they're taxed very highly in their individual states, and they have all of those other hurdles to jump through. It's you know, I think that people from outside the industry really think that people in the cannabis industry are just making money hand over fist and just becoming super rich, when in most cases, most of our clients, most of the, you know, people that I talk to on a daily basis, that is not the case. A lot of them are just coming out even and reinvesting into the business and hoping that it pays off later down the line. And I think that people are surprised by that because they think of it as alcohol. Because, you know, you compare this to like the Kennedys, you know, back in the day when they were bootleggers, you know, the Rockefellers, they were bootleggers. Alcohol became legalized again, right? Prohibition was over. They were the ones that had the capital and the booze to start their own liquor stores. And that's kind of how that, it's kind of like the same thing, right? I mean, people, I don't know. It's like right now we're building this amazing, you know, community, but right now we just can't, we don't have the tools, normal tools for running a business that we are able to have, being able to write things off for our business, for instance, and, you know, being able to, I don't know, work in a norm on a normal basis, like everybody else. And we're kind of starting to build this beautiful, wonderful empire. I mean, there's so many jobs now. It's like insane how many people work in cannabis now. And it's great. It could essentially save our economy from this insane pandemic that we've been going through. And people aren't really realizing that. So I'm hoping that something will get passed eventually. And I'm hoping that if nothing else, the Safe Banking Act will go through eventually, or at least some version of it.
Yeah, just baby steps. Just give us something.
Right. Please.
well, switching gears a little bit. So Alay Consulting also works with psilocybin producers. So walk me through, how different is that from a cannabis producer or a cannabis company that you work with?
Well, it's very different because it's illegal at this moment. So in Oregon, Oregon's the only state that has passed a legalized psilocybin law or psychedelics law. And they've decriminalized all drugs in Oregon, which it was kind of crazy and surprising to me, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. And I think that psilocybin has amazing medical benefits. I think that it could potentially, you know, lead us to some cures for a lot of things that we've, you know, our country has been struggling with: depression, PTSD, you know, anxiety, that kind of thing. And there's been a lot of studies done from even back in the 70s that show that these kinds of things can be helped with these different psychedelics. Psilocybin for sure. And so I think it's very, very different. When you walk into a mushroom grow versus a cannabis grow, they are very, very different. You really can't see very well in a mushroom grow, which I was like, oh, this is fun. But yeah, it's right now, because there are no licenses available. So they're writing the regulations right now for therapeutic use. So it's essentially, you will get a prescription for this. You will come into a very safe environment with a therapist of some sort or a shaman that has, you know, the education and has a license to do so. And then you would take it there and be walked through the process and all of that. And they have seen, you know, some really great results with this kind of therapy. And I, like I said, I'm hoping that it opens up a whole lot of avenues to see, you know, new medicines and new ways of doing things and solving issues. But you know, those licenses aren't coming out until 2023. So most of our clients that we're working with now own like a lion's mane mushroom farm, right? And they want to get GACP certification, which is a good agricultural practices certification. There's one specific to mushroom grows. And you know, they're getting things like that so that they can look really good on an application when they decide to move forward and try to switch over to psilocybin. That is about the extent of what we've seen so far, because the regulations haven't even been put out. So, you know, we don't even know where we can put mushroom grows. We're not even sure, you know, what the like dispensary storefront would look like with that, or what the track and trace would look like. So they're figuring all that out right now. And I've joined several of the work groups to discuss these kinds of things. And it's been really interesting so far. And You know, I'm hoping that they can at least learn from cannabis, because the good thing is that all the regulations we've put in place for cannabis, a lot of them can actually be used in this industry. And a lot of the lessons that we've learned, you know, we can use in building those regulations. So it is very different, but it's kind of similar in the like culture, right? A lot of people that are involved in the cannabis industry are also proponents of psilocybin. And so, you know, you kind of, it's kind of the same people a lot of times. But yeah, other than that, it's very different. I think the regulations are going to be very different. There are already food safety and public health regulations written specific to mushroom production and processing and all of that. So once again, I don't think we're going to have to reinvent the wheel at any time, but obviously warning labels and things like that will, they're probably going to steal that from cannabis, because they're going to run into the same issues as well. So yeah, it's very different, but I'm very excited about it. And hopefully it moves forward soon.
This reminds me, I remember, John, we were talking to someone a couple of years ago, and they, I think they asked a question like, how did the people learn to do this? You know, how did they learn to grow this? And John's answer was, well, they've been doing it illegally for years. You know, you need to go to school for it. You know, this is just, it just became legal in certain states. So it seems like that's going to be kind of that legacy. People that have already been doing this for a while can come into the light.
That's the way cannabis started.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Like every person that got a license in the beginning had been growing in their basement for 40 years, you know, and now had an opportunity to, you know, live that American dream and actually make it into something that was real. And, you know, I don't know, could be part of society and not be shunned for what they're doing, which I, you know, I think that's really great, especially when it's substances that aren't really doing much harm. You know, there aren't people overdosing or starting fights or, you know, who are smoking cannabis generally. And so, you know, obviously when you think of other drugs or even alcohol and the damages that it does to societies, you know, I feel really good with the plant medicine side of everything. I'm like, yes, let's get some of these things legalized.
Well, I think I read an article about psilocybin that treating alcoholism. It's like one of the things that can treat for that. So that could be a huge thing.
Yeah. So it's weird. It's essentially, and I am not an expert on, you know, the way that it works in your brain, but the way that it has been described to me when it comes to like the alcoholism or just substance abuse, it essentially during therapy sessions while you're on it, they talk you through ways to rewire your brain and to think about the substance differently. And so if you change your chemical response and relationship to the substance that you're addicted to, through a series, right? It's not just one time. You got to keep going. It's a work. But I just thought it was so fascinating, because I actually did meet a person at one of the conferences that used to be like a really bad heroin addict and used psilocybin and going to, you know, a shaman and all of this, and got off of heroin because of psilocybin. And I'm like, that is just crazy to me, because heroin is one of the worst addictions ever. And, you know, that it ruins lives. So if we can treat people using psilocybin to, get off of these other drugs, or even off of, you know, if you have a surgery and you get addicted to opioids on accident, you know, breaking that kind of chain in your brain, I think that's one of the most fascinating things, Heather. Like, honestly, I agree with you. It's
unbelievable.
Pretty amazing.
John, I know you've been watching this industry pretty closely. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'd echo a lot of what Kim has said. You know, one of the reasons why I think the timing of this national conversation around where psilocybin sits in our pharmacopoeia is so important is, if you think about the mental trauma that we've all endured over the past 2.5 years, you know, nearly 1 million Americans dead from COVID, many, many more who've suffered kind of acute physical effects from it, the economic and social toll that it's taken on all of us. Mentally, as a society, we're in a pretty rough place. And so I think it's a really timely moment for us to be thinking about whether psilocybin can be one of the things that helps us get back to a place of normalcy, do that mental reset that helps us work through the traumas that collectively we've all endured. Two, I think it's quite interesting that we are seeing quite a number of the people who were the vanguard of the cannabis industry moving into psilocybin. Yeah. And there's two things that are happening there. One, you know, so you have these people who are really experienced in building an industry from scratch and who've built one of the most kind of regulated spaces, most regulated markets in our economy, moving to psilocybin, which I think bodes well for the expectations around what compliance is going to look like, what best practice is going to look like, and just taking some of those lessons learned from the Wild West early days in cannabis and trying to leapfrog the learning process that the cannabis industry went through as its regulatory environment matured. But fundamentally, I think this is going to look like a very different type of opportunity. You know, as Ken said, as we look at the total market opportunity, we don't necessarily see this as being, say, recreational use in the way that cannabis is being used recreationally. This is likely going to end up being much lower doses. In some cases, it's people who will use this for a very short period to go through that mental reset process, but only doing it, say, once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. But where I think the opportunity lies is in the broad base of people who could benefit from this. And so if there are... So I think there's a lot of people who could potentially benefit from this based on what the early science is suggesting, and it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves. But I think another thing that makes this different from where cannabis was at the same point in the emergence of cannabis laws is, as we look at, for example, the Canadian companies that are playing in this space, just the level of sophistication, the amount of capital that they're raising, the amount of research that they're doing, this is a completely different level of fields than cannabis was when people were still tinkering in their basements and making cellophane wrapped brownies that would be thrown next to a cash register. We're seeing a great deal more of scientific sophistication in the psilocybin space much earlier than we did at the equivalent point in cannabis. We're seeing some really, really sharp stakeholders being brought into the space. And I think that bodes well in terms of how quickly the psilocybin space could accelerate in terms of finding the intersectionality between the potential applications for psilocybin and the idealized patients or consumers for these products. It's going to be certainly an interesting handful of years ahead.
Yeah, there are so much more scientific information about psilocybin than cannabis. It's like unbelievable, actually. They've been doing studies in universities since like the 70s. And which is great. I think it's a great way to start an industry because now we know, whereas with cannabis, you know, a lot of R&D, a lot of studies are starting to happen. But, you know, when you're selling something, it's like the claims issue, right? It's like, they can't say that it cures cancer or that it helps epilepsy or that, you can't like say that because there isn't enough studies done to like prove it, even though we've seen it kind of happen in several instances, but because it wasn't an actual peer-reviewed study, you can't say that. Whereas with psilocybin, they're already, they're starting with a lot more evidence. And it's really a great place, I think, for it to go and to start, especially on this therapeutic level. I think it's going to give us a lot more, a lot more freedom in the way that we can do things and the way that we can say things and the way that we can run the industry itself. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it mature and just see what happens. Cause I think you're right. It's so timely because regardless of what anybody says, we've all been through some major crap in the last couple of years. We've all suffered. We've all, felt disconnected. We've all had, mental stress, wherever that may be. And I think you're right. It's amazing how timely this is. And I think it's coming in at a time when the United States needs it the most. So I'm hoping that we do it the right way and it gets, it gets a lot of praise and hopefully it goes smoothly.
Same. Okay. Well, we're almost out of time, but we want to give our guests the opportunity to give a shout out to someone in the industry that you think is doing something great.
Yeah. Ari Cohen, he's a good friend of mine. He actually runs a delivery service, one of the first delivery service. He's a social equity candidate that applied for his license not that long ago and is also working with a lot of other social equity applicants in Denver, Colorado, and really crushing it right now. So shout out to Ari. Happy that he is in my life and part of my cannabis circle. So there's a lot of people. I feel like there's 50 people I could have done shout outs to.
I know we've had shout outs for people that are like dead or, you know, just came into the industry. So we've had them all, but Kim, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us. And John, as always, it's always a pleasure. And thank you to our listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. And if you really love us, give us a 5-star review. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.